Yesterday I discussed with you something about Jansenism. The details of its history are very interesting. A long time could be spent on going into them. We do not have time for that in this course. But its relation to the Jesuits, who have been, at least till recently, a very vital factor, and maybe a more vital factor today than many realize, was a very important part of their history. And since Blaise Pascal, one of the great names in the history of science and also in the history of literature, wrote the provincial letters, which deal mainly with the Jesuits in their treatment of Jansenism, and these are considered classics from various viewpoints and are very interesting in the picture they give of the Jesuits in view of the great study and personal contact that Pascal had with them, I would like you to read these provincial letters. Now, the provincial letters are sometimes published by themselves. There have been many editions of them. If you want to read them in the original French, of course, that's all the better because they are a great French classic. But even in English, there have been many editions of them. There are copies of them in a small volume by themselves. More frequently, they are printed together with his pensées. And sometimes the volume may be called Pascal Pensées, but half the volume is the provincial letters. Now, we should have 10 copies in the library. I looked in there yesterday and found there the last 7 of the 10. That is copy 10 and back down. But the first 3 are not in there at the moment. However, I think with 7 you can get around all right using them there. I hope the other 3 may show up. But we will take 5 of them to an assignment. And I'd like you to read them, not to read them with tremendous care. You don't need to read extremely slow. Get the main points and write a brief summary of each letter. Please head these according to, say, letter 1, letter 2. I have found in the past with some of the assignments, it's been rather slow checking on how well the work was done because you have not divided it clearly into the sections you were dealing with. And naturally, each one expresses it differently, so sometimes it's a little hard to be exactly sure how much you've covered. So please say letter 1 in the middle of the page and then discuss it. A brief summary of each letter. Now, the first 5 letters then are due next Monday at 4. The next 5 letters are due a week from this coming Friday at 4. And I will not give any assignments in this class during the 2 weeks when Mr. Maris is lecturing here. We will have the other 9 after the spring vacation. But those 2 assignments for the present. I don't know if I need to post it. I think you all have heard it now. And I hope you've noted it down. The first 5 assignments by next Monday at 4. The next 5 letters by the following Friday at 4. Now, yesterday we spoke about Jansenism and we saw how completely the French monarchy, under the push and activities and financings of the Jesuits, completely destroyed Jansenism in France. So, in the meantime, there were thousands of people who had been affected by it, and there was a very considerable Jansenist church which escaped to Holland, and included, of course, also some in Holland who were affected by it, and continued there for some centuries. But now I want to speak briefly of another movement in France at this time. And this movement has been generally called Quietism. Quietism. We will not have time to do much more than briefly introduce this movement, but it is one which still has its effects today, and so it is one which you certainly should know a little bit about. Now, this movement called Quietism is a movement which actually began in Spain. It began with a religious writer and leader in Spain named Molinos, M-O-L-I-N-O-S. And Molinos put great stress on the personal relation to God. And that is the central idea of Quietism. The personal relation to God. There are 3 names outstanding in connection with Quietism, of whom Molinos is the first. The second is Madame Guyon, G-U-Y-O-N, a French woman. And I just noticed a couple of days ago a very beautifully printed paperback book which my wife had, which on the front said it was, I believe it was a book by Madame Guyon, a translation in English, and it said her only crime was to desire to really know the love of God. Now, that's what was printed on the cover of this book, which has been published by one of our Protestant book companies within the last year or two, I believe. I have not looked into it. I have not reread her writings at all, but I have read enough about it to give you a general idea of the movement. There is in this movement, as in the movement which started at about the same time or slightly later in Germany, which had a different name, Pietism, which we will discuss under the next century, there is in both of them the great stress on what is truly a vital aspect of Christianity, that is the relation of the individual to God. And when we lose sight of that, we lose the very heart of our religion. That James said, thou believest in one God, thou doest well. The devils believe and tremble. And I'm sure there will be very orthodox people in hell. That is, there will be people there who have believed all the great doctrines of Christianity. Nobody is saved by believing that any doctrine is true. Mere intellectual faith will save nobody. And many people become so wrapped up with wishing to have precise and correct statements about biblical teaching that they forget that, as the Westminster Confession says, all truth is there for the purpose of increasing godliness. The truth is not something that stands in the air, and the vital thing is that we say it's there. The truth is something which God gives us because it should have an effect upon us. There are thousands of great truths, millions that the Lord knows that we'll never learn in this life. But he's given us the ones that are important for our lives so we can know them. Now, when people put their stress upon arguing over details of truth and neglect or minimize or forget altogether the importance of the truth in the life, there is apt to come a reaction in the form of those who stress the personal relationship to the extent that they may lose touch with the truth upon which that relationship must be founded if it is going to be of any value whatever. And that is the serious question about this quietist movement, whether it puts so much stress on a personal relationship with God without putting enough stress on the only way that we can really learn who God is or what he is or can really feed upon his truth, which is through the study of his word, through dealing with those great facts that he has given to us, that sometimes such movements get off into an area which is harmful rather than helpful. I would say that a person who knows a little truth, who knows the great truth of salvation, and who truly loves the Lord is far better off than a person who knows a great deal of truth and does not personally know the Lord. But God does not wish us to neglect either aspect, both of which are so vital. So this Molinos in Spain, just how much reality there was to his knowledge of God, I do not know. But he put such stress in his writings on personal relationships with God and personal experiences that the impression was very soon received that he completely minimized the sacraments and the church organization and these things which meant so much to the established Roman Catholic Church in Spain. And one of the popes drew 65 propositions from his work which he condemned as heretical. And Molinos' work was so condemned by the established church that it had little continuing influence in Spain. How directly he influenced Madame Guyon, I do not know, but they usually referred at this time to anything like what she was doing as being a carrying on of Molinos' attitude and activity. And Madame Guyon was a French woman who laid great stress on the personal relationship with God and the love of God and carried it so far that she felt that if one sought personal salvation, one was getting away from giving the proper emphasis to the relationship to God. That one must simply love God for himself. Now, it is true we should love God for himself, but everyone who has been saved from his sin through Christ and who realizes what it means and what Christ did for him and what he has been saved for should be so grateful for his own personal salvation that certainly this should be a very large factor of his relationship to Christ. Well, Madame Guyon was a personable French woman who was filled with enthusiasm for these aspects of Christianity, and perhaps minimized other aspects to some extent. She had a great influence on others. She was arrested and she was imprisoned for several months on various occasions. One of the leading ecclesiastics of France very strongly opposed her. Eventually, she being connected with a high nobility in France, eventually she was permitted to leave the prison and to go to her country estate, provided she stay there. So she was in a sort of a prison for the last 20 years of her life. I have here the Catholic Encyclopedia, not this recent one that has just come out, but the one that was standard for so many years, which appeared in 1910. And in it, this article, there's a long article on Madame Guyon, in which, after telling about the criticisms of her and her imprisonment and so on, then it tells of her great posthumous success, how her writings were published in Holland in 1704. Englishmen and Germans visited her at her country estate, and how widely she protested in her will. When she died at 68, she died submissive to the Catholic Church, from which she never had any intention of separating herself. Her doctrines, like her life, have nevertheless given rise to the widest divergencies of opinion. And then he goes on to say that it's remarkable that her disciples at the court of Louis XIV were always persons of great piety and of exemplary life. But it continues, on the other hand, Madame Guyon's warmest partisans after her death were to be found among the Protestants. It was a Dutch Protestant, the pastor Poiret, who began the publication of her works. A Swiss pietist pastor continued. Her life was translated into English and German, and her ideas, long since forgotten in France, have for generations been in favor in Germany, Switzerland, England, and among Methodists in America. Now that is the conclusion to the long article about her in the Catholic Encyclopedia. And I would feel that probably anyone in reading her works would find something that would be helpful in your Christian life, but I think you should read them with caution. I would not, in view of the general background situation, I wouldn't be surprised if you would find some statements which were definitely erroneous, and that you would, more important, you would find some omissions that are vital. But she has had a great influence, and we should be aware of her. Now, the third name to mention in this connection is Bishop Fenelon, F-E-N-E-L-O-N. And Bishop Fenelon was a French bishop who strongly defended Madame Guyon and who suffered for his defense of her. And his name, F-E-N-E-L-O-N, his name is often referred to in this same connection of this quietist movement. Now, with this brief view of these events in France, we turn back to Great Britain. And so, capital E is Great Britain. The religious life of Great Britain from 1660 to 1700. 1660 to 1700. And under that, number one, we will call the re-establishment of the monarchy. The re-establishment of the monarchy. We have already seen how that came about. We have already seen how in the time of the Commonwealth and just before it, how the great mass of the Puritans and the bulk of the Puritan leaders desired to keep the monarchy, but to have it limited in power and have it understood the king is supposed to follow biblical precepts and not to interfere with the church, and to have the church, instead of being ruled by the king, be ruled by the representatives of its people together with the trained pastors, both working together in an organization to control the church and to see to it that the truth of God is spread through all the country, even as Elizabeth had spread Protestantism through the country and changed it from 90% Romanist to 90% or more Protestant in the course of her reign. Now, the small group of independents, which included some very outstanding men among them, had opposed this attitude of the bulk of the Puritan leaders. And if they had been willing to go along, understanding that they would be given full toleration for the efforts they wished to carry on, which the Presbyterian and Puritan leadership was very ready to grant, if they had been ready to do that, who knows whether there might have been continued Puritan leadership in England for another two or three centuries. But the independents refused to do this, and they had control of the army. And then when the independents got control, and then they had the land completely in their control for 10 years, but it was the army that was controlling, then if the Presbyterians had been ready to say, well, we don't altogether approve of this sort of government, but we're willing to go along with it and support it, and we rejoice in the toleration and freedom of religion that we have, perhaps somebody could have been found to be a worthy successor to Cromwell, and Puritanism might have continued at least another 40 or 50 years. But they, in their turn, refused to agree, and many of them, like Baxter, spoke favorably to the representatives of young Charles who were going about the country trying to get support for the return of the king. And so Charles promised that he would give them toleration. He promised every group in England that they would be free from any persecution except for those who had directly participated in the condemnation of his father to death. Those individuals were sought out, as many as could be found, and submitted to terrible tortures and killed. But after all, for such a great turnover, it was a comparatively small number. So that comparatively, it was a comparatively bloodless change when Charles came back. But Charles had good advisors, and his advisors advised him when he wrote these beautiful statements of toleration, which he promised to include in every one of them, that I am willing and happy to give just as full a degree of tolerance as the Parliament shall choose to vote. And thus he put the onus on the Parliament. And as far as political results are concerned, the revolution of the mid-17th century in England did have lasting results. In religious things, it resulted in a great setback for Christianity after a tremendous push forward for a few years. But in political things, it did have its results. Because, as you remember, in 1640, when the Long Parliament turned against Charles, they didn't like Charles's autocratic government, his directing the church himself without paying attention to what they wanted, his levying taxes under various excuses without their approval, and so on. Well, Charles II, his son, when he came back, said, I'm glad to give full toleration, just as full as the Parliament may choose to grant. And the Parliament had a power under Charles II far beyond what it had ever had before in English history. And the Parliament now was a very representative of the great mass of the English landholders. And this mass of the English landholders were country squires who had a fairly good living without much work, highly respected in their communities, engaging in all kinds of sports, and some perfectly all right and some that weren't all right, but not very seriously interested in most things. In the Parliament previously, maybe a third of the Parliament of 1640 had been made up of them, but they had not said a great deal. And when the division came, they had stood with the king. But now the new Parliament was overwhelmingly made up of those who wanted the king back and who were very disgusted the king had ever been put out. Yes, Mr. Lee?
Was this a result of an illegal election?
Yeah. See, the election was held for a new Parliament. And in the new parliament, everywhere, people said, isn't this wonderful? King Charles is back. Now we're free from this business of having major generals telling us what we've got to do. Now, the major generals had given a tremendous amount of freedom, but they had maintained order in the country, and they had refused to allow any religious persecution, and there were many things that these squires and others hadn't liked. And, of course, any of those who held meetings to bring the king back, they were put down with force. And a great many of the people felt, well, the rule of the saints, as some called it, they were very glad to be rid of. And the result was that in this particular election, the emphasis was on people who stood for the king. That's who we want. People who supported the king right through. And anybody who had been a strong opponent of the king, people were suspicious of. And the result was that the parliament was probably much more royalist than the country as a whole. But it was overwhelmingly in the hands of those who felt that the events of the previous 20 years were extremely sad. And in fact, they listed Charles as king, not from 1660, but from 1649. That is, they considered he'd been king ever since his father was put to death. And they ordered that Cromwell's body and those of his leading supporters be dug up from their graves and be hung publicly on gibbets, where they would hang for people to see them for until they completely disintegrated. And for the next 200 years, nothing was written in England that referred to Cromwell as other than a terrible, wicked malefactor who had greatly injured the country. It was 200 years later that Thomas Carlyle and Lord Macaulay and some others went into the records and wrote books praising Cromwell and giving him part of the credit that surely is his due. He was not a perfect man. He had his errors, he had his mistakes, but he's one of the greatest men in English history, and far greater than any king that England ever had. But the monarchy was reestablished, and Charles II, I think, was sincere when he said he wanted to give toleration. I don't think he cared much one way or the other. In fact, when his strong royalist counselors had their meetings in considering policies for the nation, some of them complained that the king would be making faces at them behind their backs and kind of mimicking the way they talked and making fun of them and getting tired of the long meetings. And they felt that he should very seriously consider how they could establish things so they would last the way they wanted them. But as long as he had all the mistresses he wanted, and that was plenty, and had all the other wickedness he wanted, why, he didn't care much about what happened in the country. And during his reign, the theaters, which the Puritans had closed, were reopened. But in the theaters now, the plays that were written, as Lord Macaulay said, were of a different type than anything that had appeared before in the theater or that did after, up to Macaulay's time, which is 100 years ago, anything that had at his time. That is to say, the plays in those days, the Restoration comedy, as they call it, did not simply depict vice. It glorified vice. The man who was the great hero of most of these plays would be a man who would seduce a married woman in most of them. And they made fun of and ridiculed the husbands who were of the wives who were thus seduced. And some of these plays were very, very clever. Some of them have been re-shown in the last few years. But during a period of 150 to 200 years, they were generally regarded as something that England was not very proud of, because that was the sort of thing that Charles and his little coterie of friends liked. But Charles didn't try, like his father, to force things on the nation. The Parliament pretty well ran the country during his reign, in most things. And the Parliament was determined there must not be a repetition of anything like they'd had before. And so, while not many people were hunted down, Richard Cromwell fled to the continent and hid under another name for 15 years, but then he returned to England and he was not bothered. A few people were tortured and killed, but comparatively few in England were for past political attitudes. But the Parliament, within the first two or three years, began to make restrictive laws about preaching. And they ordered that nobody should be allowed to preach in any English church who did not declare that he accepted everything in the English prayer book from his heart and did not desire any changes whatever in it. Not merely that he was willing to follow it, but he accepted it all from his heart. And they passed a law that nobody could preach in an English church, either as a minister or as one invited by a minister, unless he first signed a statement that he considered that it was wicked under any conditions to oppose a king or to use force against a king. They made various rules like this, which resulted in over 2,000 ministers leaving their places. And these included many of the finest, godliest Christians in the land. And then they passed such laws as that no minister who had been a minister before, anyone who had become a minister since somewhere in the 30s, in fact, was compelled to seek ordination over again. No ordinations in between were accepted. They had to be re-examined to be sure of their loyalty to the king. And anyone who had been a minister or had preached much during that period was not allowed to come at all within 5 miles of a town in which he had previously been an established minister. And all these restrictive laws were passed. And for 25 years, there were little groups of Christians here and there which carried on their faith. But there was very little chance to reach out or to reach the new generation. And so all the churches decreased in size greatly during this period. Yes, Mr.
What was that period when they had to be
raised? It was somewhere in the 1630s. I forget the exact year. It may have been 1636 was about there. But anyone since that time, up till 1606, who had become, had to now be re-examined to be sure that he was thoroughly for the king and not for any kind of a church that had a power independent of the king. Of course, the king was only nominal at this time as far as head of the church was concerned. He had the authority if he chose, but it was actually these parliamentary leaders who determined what the church should be. Now, number two is Scotland. Charles had a special animosity toward the Presbyterians of Scotland. Now, this may have been based upon the fact that when his father was killed in 1649, and when the Scotch had immediately recognized that Charles I being dead, his son Charles II was king, and they welcomed him as king, they insisted he must sign the covenant. And Charles had signed the covenant, but he detested the thing. But he signed it, that he would give his life's blood to support the established Reformed Church in Scotland and to try to reform the churches of England and Ireland in line with the activities of the best Reformed churches in the world. And Charles had signed this covenant, and the Scotch had formally crowned him on the throne of the ancient Scottish kings after he signed it. But then Cromwell had defeated the Scotch forces and had left an army under General Monk to maintain order in Scotland for 10 years. Charles had to flee to the continent, where he was with his cousin, Louis the 14th, the young Louis of France. And Louis was not yet the absolute autocratic king he became later, but he was doubtless planning to be. Now, Charles immediately sent a force to Scotland. And he said, in Scotland, the Scottish church is to be re-established in line with the English church. And consequently, they gave the orders in Scotland that the men who had been the leaders of the covenanters were to be tried for treason. The Marquess of Argyll, who had been one of the leaders of the and who had personally crowned the king, crowned Charles II in 1651 in Scotland. He came up to London to give his congratulations to Charles on being king, but he was immediately seized and imprisoned and sent back to Scotland. The Marquess of Argyle, A-R-G-Y-L-E, sent back to Scotland to be tried for high treason. And there he was tried for high treason and was ordered publicly beheaded in Edinburgh. And the leading ministers of the Church of Scotland, who had also supported the covenant, were hanged publicly in Edinburgh. And the troops then, composed of the English troops and composed of those some in Scotland who joined with them in their support of the king, the troops were set to work to establish the Scotch church in complete line with the Church of England. The result was that there were hundreds of fine pastors in the Scotch churches who were expelled from their churches or who voluntarily left them in view of the situation that they faced. And they had to fill up these positions, and they filled up the positions in the churches with many untrained people, many of them wicked young men who simply were willing to say they'll do whatever the king wanted. And so the churches in Scotland now became filled with pastors of very low type, and the people were ordered always to attend the churches with severe penalties if they failed to be present. Many of the Scotch people began going out into the hills, and some of the old pastors would hold services there. So Charles's government made a law against conventicles, any kind of a religious meeting that was not under the auspices of the established church. They called a conventicle. There was a man named Sharp who had been among the Covenanters and whom the Covenanters had sent over to France to deal with Charles and to see if he would support the church in Scotland if he came back as king. And he said, of course, he would. But then when he got back to England, they sent Sharp again up to London, and Sharp saw how things were going and changed his attitude. And they made him the archbishop, head of the Scottish church. So they established archbishops and bishops in control of the Scottish church. And everyone was ordered to attend the services regularly under severe penalty and never to have any other services. And a period now of 28 years occurred, which is referred to in Scottish history as the killing time. Because this was a period in which many great Scotch Christians were hanged or beheaded or simply shot out of hand, simply for their trying to stand by the Bible and their desire to reestablish Presbyterian system of church government in Scotland instead of the system where the king appointed the archbishops and they appointed the ministers, and many of them were of a very low type. Yes?
Who was that fellow who said he was an archbishop?
Sharp, S-H-A-R-P, Archbishop Sharp. He was for the next 20 years nearly archbishop. Eventually, some men killed him, and that made something of an upheaval last for a time. Yes? They were prosecuted in some cases for not attending the church services under these ungodly men whom they put in charge of the services. They were in most cases persecuted for holding their own services out in the hills or somewhere. That was and they were forced to, anyone was subject to severe punishment, often death, if he would not repudiate the covenant. Two young girls were seized and ordered to repudiate the covenant. And they refused, and they were taken to the shore where the tide was coming in. And they were tied there so that the water would gradually come up over their heads. And when the water came over their heads and they began to drown, then they pulled them out and resuscitated them and said, "Will you promise to forswear the covenant to do what the king says in the church?" And when they refused again, they were tied a little higher so that the tide came on up and went over them. And when they again lost consciousness, they again resuscitate them. They do this two or three times before they finally let them drop. Now, how many other cases there were like this, I don't know. But this is one case that became greatly publicized at the time. 28 years. 28 years. 1660 to 1685. 88. 28 years. But the... it got so that many of the soldiers were free to shoot most anybody.
that they felt was either a Covenanter minister or a supporter of Covenanter ministers or one who was even supplying food or assistance of any kind to those who favored the covenant. The story is told that one of these rough soldiers grabbed a man and said, will you repudiate the covenant? I'm going to shoot you if you don't. And the man says, well, now he says there's two covenants, the covenant of works and the covenant of faith. Which do you want me to repudiate? And the soldier kind of scratched his head. Well, he says, we weren't told which. I guess either will do. Well, he says, suppose I repudiate the covenant of works. He says, all right. Well, I'm afraid there weren't many cases in which people escaped by such expedients as this. The last of the martyrs, the last of the Covenanter martyrs, was a man named James Renwick, who was only born in 1660, about the time Charles came back as king. And James Renwick had gone to the continent and had studied there and had been ordained in Holland. But he felt that he should do what he could to help his suffering people in Scotland. And so he made his way back to Scotland and managed to get into the country without being caught. And he went about to the little groups of Christians in one part of the country to another, preaching to them, presenting the word of life, and discussing the Bible with them. A price was put on his head. He was hunted down. Eventually he was caught. And he was hung in the main square in Edinburgh. But before being hung, he was given opportunity, as most of these men were, to make a public statement. And I have a book called Scots Worthies that gives the statements made by many of these men as they declared their readiness to lay down their lives rather than to force their belief in Christ. And James Renwick was the last of those slain, because events in England brought the killing time to an end in Scotland after 28 years. And so after these 28 years, then in Scotland, Scotch people were allowed to establish the church that they wished, which was a return to the Presbyterian system they had had since the days of John Knox. And Scotch church was reestablished on this line. But those who had been accustomed to the Episcopal service during the 28 years and come to like it were permitted to carry on their Episcopal services as they desired in Scotland after that. And so there remained a very small Episcopal church in Scotland, which is the ancestor of the Episcopal churches in America. But it continued on after this, but the great bulk of the Scotch people from this time on had the Westminster Confession as their standard and were not interfered with by the same troubles as before. They had other new troubles at later times that we will look at later. But now, number three, the destruction of Puritanism in England. And this we have spoken of already. We've anticipated a fair amount. We don't need to go into the details much. It would be interesting if we could. If I could, for instance, read to you of Baxter's, the account of Baxter's trial, where Baxter, as a rather old man, had published a book of comments on the New Testament, and the judge claimed that some of these comments reflected on the full power of the king. And he was brought to trial there, and he was, the way the Judge Jeffrey spoke to him was beyond belief, the way he called him a scoundrel and talked to him in the court, and he was sentenced to a certain time in prison and a certain time of being marched through the streets of London with signs up proclaiming him to have been a miscreant and a wicked man, while all he'd been doing was occasionally preaching and sometimes getting caught at it and being arrested and writing books that did not praise the king as much as the royalist leaders felt they should be. But there was not the same sort of a murderous persecution in England as there was in Scotland. It principally amounted to making it impossible for the men to preach. You take John Bunyan, he was in the jail, which was uncomfortable, but the jailers were friendly to him. He was fairly well treated. His worst thing was that he could not work to support his family, which made his They put his family in a very difficult situation during those years. But any minute he could have left the jail and walked out if he would just give his word that he would not preach. But John Bunyan would not give that word. And of course, eventually, the sailor who had saved Charles's life got in touch with Charles, and Charles gave him a personal permission to preach. And so John Bunyan could preach after that. And the Puritanism was destroyed in England as a result of the people not merely not being required to hear Christian preaching, not being permitted to hear it, it being practically cut out. This was not a destruction of Christianity in England. It was a destruction of vivid, active, energetic Christianity, but not a destruction of Christianity, because everyone was required to go to the church, and while the rector might be a fox-hunting, hard-drinking man, he would read the service which Cranmer had arranged with those wonderful words which present the gospel at many points. And he would, they would read from the scripture. It was not like Bohemia and Austria and Italy, where it was impossible to hear the gospel. The gospel was available if a person searched for it. John Bunyan's works began to be distributed and had some influence. There were some of the bishops who were godly men who devoted themselves to trying to write in defense of Christianity, though there were other men who were writing against it. But the mass of the nation became less and less interested in religion. And England was definitely a Christian nation at the end of this period, but not a nation of enthusiastic or earnest Christians, a nation in which a great bulk were simply nominal Christians. No one, according to a law passed during this time, could hold any position in the state or in the army who did not at least once a quarter take communion in accordance with the provisions of the Church of England. And this was to cut out all Presbyterians or Independents or dissenters of any kind from any position in church and state, and also the Roman Catholics. Now, number four is the reign of James II. For the reign of James II, the average person doesn't realize that when you say Charles II and when you say James II, both kings of England, Charles II reigned 25 years and James II 3 years. And that's a tremendous difference. James II was the younger brother of Charles II. James II was a man whose position has a permanent undying fame, because he was Duke of York, and after him was named the city of New York, therefore. Because while he was Duke of York, the English forces took New Amsterdam from the Dutch. And so they named it after him, New York. But James II, the younger brother of Charles, in about 1685, somewhere along there, he became publicly a Roman Catholic. Now, both Charles and James had been raised by their mother, who was an ardent Roman Catholic. She'd been raised by the Jesuits. Both of them had lived at the French court. Charles never publicly admitted he was a Roman Catholic, but on his deathbed, he secretly had the rites of the Roman Catholic Church given to him. James was publicly announced himself a Roman Catholic. And though Charles had a number of illegitimate sons, his own wife had borne him no child. And so the English people knew that the next in line was James. And James was an ardent Roman Catholic. And at this time, Louis XIV was carrying on his extensive persecution against the Protestants. And the people of England were afraid of their life, of the establishment of Inquisition in England and of Roman Catholic control. They were terribly afraid that might come in England, as it was in France then. And so they tried to get a law through Parliament that James could not succeed Charles. But now Charles really exerted himself. He didn't want his brother cut out from the succession. And the hardcore royalists stood with him. And they won in Parliament to prevent this law from being established, the law of exclusion of James from being king. Well, when Charles died in 1685, James became king. And with a man king who was a pronounced Roman Catholic, the people of England were, many of them, terrified as to what was going to happen. And so quite a number of them made an uprising in order to make one of Charles' illegitimate sons, the Duke of Monmouth, king instead of his uncle, James. But the uprising was put down with terrible slaughter, and many of the people who participated were sent as slaves to America. And then James, was king, proceeded to give personal release from the law to many Roman Catholics, even as his brother had given to John Bunyan, so that though the law said nobody could have a position in the army or in the state who did not take communion in accordance with the law with the Church of England, that is, take communion as a member of the Church of England, James gave individual exemption to man after man after man, until soon most of the leading positions in the army were in the hands of pronounced Roman Catholics. And it was very evident that James was moving in order to establish Roman Catholicism in England. Now, James had been married to a Protestant woman, and they had two daughters. And these daughters were now grown. One of them was the wife of the stadtholder of the Netherlands. She was living in the Netherlands. This was while before James announced himself as a Roman Catholic. Now he married again a Roman Catholic woman from the continent. And the story was given out that they had a son. And people figured, now when James dies, we have another Roman Catholic king, and this can go on. The nation will just be completely brought under the control of the Pope. And so now James became impatient to move a little faster. Well, I think they found that in this case, the son wasn't really a son of James, that there had been they had smuggled in a baby to pretend it was a son. And I think this was proven in that case. So they made a law that, up to this day, up until just recently it was repealed, within the last 10 years, that any royal child in England, the Minister of Home Affairs has to be present when the child is born to certify that this really was the child of the ruler. But James, I don't think his actual son was born until later. I'm not quite sure on that. But at any rate, James proceeded to order that Roman Catholics be released from the rules against them, and dissenters. He made it apply to all of them, do away with the previous intolerance, and he ordered that this must be read in all the churches, this order exempting them from all the restrictive measures. And the dissenters all said, this is just done in order to bring us under worse tyranny under Roman Catholic control. We refuse to accept this. As they did not want it, they would have liked it, but they understood what the purpose of it was, and they refused to accept it. And then James brought charges against seven of the bishops of the Church of England because they refused to read this order. And Macaulay says how inconsistent people are. He says, James figured, the bishops of the Church of England are all sworn that they will not resist the king under any circumstances, and the king is the head of the church. Therefore, he thought, even if he did that which would mean their destruction in the end, they would stand behind them. Well, Macaulay says, James believed, certainly as an ardent Roman Catholic, that adultery was wrong. And yet he was just as licentious as his brother, except less fastidious in his selection. And but he thought, the bishops have taken this oath. They will allow me to destroy them because they've sworn that I am the divinely appointed head of the church. Well, the bishops didn't do it. They refused to take it. So they were all charged with treason. They had a big trial, and they were acquitted. And when the bishops were acquitted, word went all over England, and there was tremendous rejoicing. The bishops were acquitted. But James got the impression there was going to be an uprising, and some of the people had been negotiating with the stadtholder of Holland, who was actually a cousin of James, his mother being a daughter of Charles I, and his wife being the daughter of James. Negotiate with him to come over to England and save them from James. And James, very foolishly, got scared and fled. And so he fled, and William of Holland came over to England. And the English, for once, the royalists and the dissenters, all the different groups united for a very brief time. And they welcomed William as king. And so they made William king. And James went to France, where Louis recognized him as king of England for the rest of his life, and his son as kings of England. But in England, the result was the doing away with the laws of persecution. So from 1688 on, there was religious toleration, but there was nobody more to tolerate. The new generation had been grown up that knew nothing about Puritanism. So there was toleration, but nobody to tolerate for the next 50 years. But the political, this is the political history, which isn't directly part of our church history, but it's important to see how 1688 meant the end of the killing time in Scotland. 1688 meant the Puritan preachers now had freedom to preach, but there were none of them left to preach. They'd all died off by this time. So I don't say all, but there's practically nothing left. Puritanism was ended. Our next subject is how God preserved a portion of English Puritanism and established a great new Christian center far across the sea. We continue with that tomorrow.